By the time I got to Rwanda, I had learned one of the most important lessons of my life from failure, and that was humility. We so often come in as outsiders with answers. If you come in as a guest and start asking questions and listen to other people and who they are and what they want first, and you do that long enough and you show up through thick and through thin, over time you'll be treated as a local. And I think that was the secret sauce, plus the fact that you are not spending the rest of your life here. And so if you want to build an institution, it has to be Rwandan. And number one, you need co-founders, and two, you can never take credit. You can share it, but you can never take it.
Wouldn't you describe as maniacal and just going at lightning speed at the time? What would you like as a co-founder back then?
First of all, I'm still described as maniacal by some people and going all the time. I worked with the first three women parliamentarians in the country, and so this was not their day job. However, without them, we wouldn't have had the legitimacy, the contacts, and I could roll up my sleeves with two other women who were more at my level to get things done. We had fun. But at one point, because I was such a lunatic in terms of how fast I moved, I got malaria. And Immaculée, one of the parliamentarians, came to my bed and said, "Well, now that you're finally sitting still, there's something I need to tell you. You're going too fast. And we can't keep up with you." I actually had a mentor at the time, a woman named Mary Rosales from the Philippines. And I went to her in tears because I felt that I was failing again because I was moving so fast. And she said, "Let's problem solve this. How would we organize it so that progress could be made, but you could constantly be creating the power in other people?" Over time, became Rwandan. And now, if you walked in, nobody would even know who I am. And that to me is success, that you work with people, you let them lead, and your footsteps disappear.
I wanted at this point to talk about Agnes. So Agnes is one of the co-founders, but then she later became one of the highest ranking planners in the Rwandan genocide. Did it make you question who you were working with and thinking, gosh, do I need to care about the monster inside of us? Some kind of safeguard to ensure we don't cross that line.
My personal interaction with it changed my understanding of what it means to be human fundamentally. Sitting across from Agnes in prison and thinking about this woman who had a freckled face and wearing a pink dress made me realize that it's too simple to try to separate the world into good people and bad people, angels and monsters. That angels and monsters live inside every single one of us, and that our monsters are our broken parts, our shames, our grievances, our insecurities, our secrets. And that in times of insecurity, and I frankly feel we're living in one of those times right now, it becomes really easy for demagogic leaders to prey on those broken parts, to blame, and sometimes to make us do terrible things. And Agnes represented that more than any other human being, because people would say, "Would you have imagined that she would have helped lead a genocide?" And I would always want to say, "How many people do you work with on a daily basis that you think, oh, you could do that?" And yet, in a world where success is defined by money, power, and fame, people start searching for power and choose power over purpose. And that's what ultimately leads us to do things that we shouldn't be doing.
I tried out to be an auctioneer and made it through a sort of series of cuts over 4 days. And I just started taking auctions night after night after night. And I laughingly say, you know, I spent a solid 5, 6, 7 years on stage taking, you know, 70, 80, 90, 100 auctions a year. And it was so painful. I wasn't particularly good. And it was just night after night of people talking over me and really having to steel myself against that and go back out on that stage night after night. But ultimately, that practice gave me the foundation, which gave me the confidence to be really good at what I do. And now people say a lot of times to me, "Do you get nervous when you get on stage?" And I really don't. I get really excited for new opportunities to be on stage in front of a new crowd or in a new place. But the fear is gone. I don't fear an audience anymore. And I think that's really what it takes to be a talented auctioneer.
That was the thing that struck me the most. You said you've gone through the very worst. There is nothing that could possibly faze you. And 500 thereabouts of your first
auctions were mediocre. Didn't you ever think maybe this isn't for me and I should move to something else?
That would have been the smarter path, perhaps. There's a really interesting thing that happens with charity auctioneering. Every stage is new. Every audience is new. Every night is new. So let's say I took 5 auctions in a week. Let's say 3 were pretty bad. And then maybe I would have that one where something went right and I felt good about it. I realized that there was an ability to train what I was doing and figure out a better way to do it. I don't think I bomb anymore. I'm past that point because I can always recover because I've bombed so many times that I know how to recover from it now. So all these lessons are important. And I like to tell people when they're pursuing their passion, it's okay that you're going to fail along the way. You just have to throw pain against the wall and keep going. Because ultimately, if you have enough conviction, you'll reach some measure of success simply because of the act of doing over and over again and refining what you're doing.
So we talked about how you helped not only to save money, but also to gain a little profit for Christie's. This was still the time where you saw them as family. And then you talked about how strategic partnerships, but there's a really vital story in between that bridges it, which is basically when you realize that, oh, you were getting far below market rate. And I would love to hear that story because that resonates with me.
So I basically had been working at the company for almost a decade at that point. You know, one of the things about working for a company like a Christie's or even at that time, sort of the magazine world was it was always about the glamour, right? And so anytime I sort of said anything about it, my boss at the time, who I adored, would just sort of say to me, like, we shouldn't really be talking about money right now. You're lucky to work here. And I agreed with him because I was like, oh, okay, yeah, of course. Like, I'm lucky to work here. Never really thinking about the fact that there were so many other people who were also working there, who were lucky to work there, but were also getting paid. And they were pretty much all guys. But basically, I was having brunch with some friends one weekend, and a friend of ours mentioned that she was buying a 1-bedroom apartment in the city. And I was so floored because even 10 years into my career, I mean, I was really still living paycheck to paycheck for the most part. Pretty much my entire salary was going to rent at that point. And I kind of pulled her aside. I was like, how are you doing this? Like, I thought, you know, we were all in the same boat here. And she was like, what are you talking about? And that for me was a real lightning moment because I realized that I had taken no ownership stake in my own career. And that includes asking for raises, but also questioning the amount that I was making. The timing was really interesting too, because there was a new head of HR who I had just trained to be an auctioneer and I'd become good friends with him. And he pulled me aside one day and said to me, you know, Lydia, you are crazily underpaid. Do you realize that? I mean, the level of emotions that passed through me at that moment, I mean, first of all, just embarrassment at the fact that I had just so willingly taken this paycheck and not pushed, but also I felt really betrayed by my company because I had worked there since I was 21. And I looked around and all I saw were friends and family. I felt like president and the chairman were like my older brother and my uncle. And I felt like my boss was my work husband, but also my best friend. I mean, it just was like so many things. I was like, wait, what? You guys knew that I was getting paid this and you guys kept doing this? Like, I thought you had my back. And that was a really great lesson about corporate. And not even about the personnel, but also just about working in an environment. And I said in the book, like, make no mistake about it. You are a number on a P&L. And if you decide or if they decide one day that you don't work there anymore, they don't care about you or your family. And you don't want that to be true, but that is the truth. And I can tell you that without any hesitation. So you do need to ask for raises and you do need to ask for things for yourself because people will pay you whatever you will show up to do the work for. And the only person who's going to change that is you. And in my opinion, when I found all this stuff out, I started sort of researching and I had gone to Moët & Hennessy to interview for a comms job. And I remember joking with the gentleman who was then at that point, the CEO, I said something, he said something about it, like the woman who was running Moët or Veuve Clicquot as an account. And I said something about, like Miss Veuve Clicquot, and I made a joke. And he's like, you can joke about it, but you know, she's making 6 figures many times over. And I really think my jaw became unhinged. I was like, wait, what are you talking about? And that kind of became the motivator I needed to go research more and start asking my friends what they were making so that I actually had an idea of what I should be making. And I was making a third of what I should have been making. And so it basically became part of a conversation where I went into my boss's office. And at the time, I wasn't really expecting to tell him that I had another job offer because I did not, in fact, have another job offer. But there was something that when I started down that road, it was like all that emotion was wrapped up in it and I couldn't stop talking. And so all of a sudden I was like, I have a job, I'm leaving in 2 weeks. And what I did know at that time was that there was no one else to run the events department. I had been there at that point for 10 years, and I had two women who'd been on my team for less than a year. And all of our top clients, all of the stuff you learn just in auction language, that was all with me at that point. And he knew that, and I knew that. And the next sort of like 10 minutes were basically this dream sequence of everything you have ever wanted anyone to say. Like, you're valued. What is it going to take to make you stay? And I'm sitting there thinking, like, I would stay for nothing. But honestly, the fact that you're saying this right now to me also makes me so angry because you never offered this to me. And so I just told him, you know, I was leaving and this is what I wanted. And because I had seen what was going on with the events department, because strategic partnerships was something I saw as a potential for the company, I pitched it at that moment. And he was totally on board. And by that afternoon, had everything signed, sealed, and delivered except the title, which of course is the funny part because that's the only thing that you can just give. He was like, well, we can't give you an international title until you sign a deal. I was like, listen, there's no step two because without step one, I don't stay. And he literally was like, oh. And then by that afternoon, I had everything I wanted to stay. And the other funny thing that I have thought about many times since is just my happiness as an employee being compensated in the way that I should have been compensated. I increased my salary 3 times over in that conversation. And so my roommate was moving out of our, you know, split one bedroom apartment, and I took over the whole apartment by myself. It was just like all of these things that I didn't even know were possible were suddenly possible because I'd asked that question and held firm on my belief that I was worth it. And that's not to say it happens every time. There were certainly many times I've asked for things that I didn't get, but it taught me to ask and not to be scared of the word no, because you're the only person who can ask that question. And again, going back to what I always say about creating the life you want, it's expensive to create the life you want. So make sure you can fund the life you want.
I've noticed that you would basically be at NASA, then Boeing, then Hyperloop. Very, very different. But it seemed as though you just don't hesitate the moment you realize that this doesn't align with certain value in my life. I'm going to switch and find something else. Normally, like for me, I find it very hard to leave, even though it doesn't align with what I'm interested in. But you don't seem to have any issue whatsoever. And I wonder why.
Yeah, I didn't notice this about myself until a bit later in life. I read a book. I forgot what book it is. It's basically like with every job, there's passion and there's your work hygiene or something like that. And if the pay is just good enough, maybe you don't love your boss, but you like them enough. And it's like you get annoyed.
You might compromise.
You still are okay with it enough. You will still kind of stay at the job. But I think for every job I had, I hit a ultimate deal breaker, which if the job was like pretty good enough and I was like pretty happy, I feel like I would have stayed much longer, but I hit deal breakers and I was like, you know what? I can't continue this. So I would go to the next job.
So what have those deal breakers been? How do you decide this is something that I can't compromise on?
So the first one was location. That's why I moved from Florida to Los Angeles. And then when I was in LA, I was working at Boeing. And for that one, that was just the pace and the work environment. Didn't love it. So I transferred. I worked at Hyperloop, which to be honest, was the best job I've had in my life. I loved it. Loved the energy. Loved my coworkers. Loved the job because, I mean, Hyperloop's not doing so hot right now. But as an engineer back in the day, you just had investors throwing like millions of dollars at you. And then they'll just say, okay, here's a bunch of money, figure out what projects you want to do that would go towards the cause of building this. And as a young engineer, it was so much fun. But for that one, that's when I figured out I actually didn't want to be an engineer anymore because I was sitting at the computer all day. I was doing really cool projects, but I felt like something was missing and I didn't know what it was, but it was actually being involved in a community, feeling like I'm interacting with people every day. And also I was really homesick for Singapore. And that was kind of when I decided, you know what, I think I need to come back home.
Was it hard for you to decide I need to leave all this? Because the opportunities, the kind of groundbreaking things that you would see in your field is happening in the US. That's where, yep, as you said, the investors are pumping hundreds of millions. You wouldn't really see that in this part of the world.
Yeah, it's true. No, it's really true. I knew if I moved back to Singapore, I would probably not do engineering anymore. And that was exactly what happened. I would say I definitely struggled coming back to Singapore because when I was in the States my whole life, I felt like I was always one step ahead of where I was. I was like, all right, I know what I'm going to do next. everything just seemed to flow so easily. And when I came back here, I got hit with a lot of actual life questions about what is my why, right? What is my why? How do I actually want to live my life every day? What truly makes me tick and happy and feel purposeful for other people as well? And those are questions I never thought about before when you're in your 20s and just doing jobs that sound cool, right? So it was difficult for me to move back to Singapore. I love it here though.
So your fiance said, regardless of everything they've done or not succeeded on, you need to put yourself out there. How did you figure out what you were going to do?
Well, that was when TikTok was starting to become big. It was already pretty big. 2021. It wasn't
big
right at the beginning. How did I decide on TikTok? So he and I had our own little accounts and we just like making like fun TikTok videos. No one could see them. It was just our personal account. But he was like, why don't you just put yourself out there on TikTok? That is so out of my comfort zone. I have not put myself on a screen before. I'm a very awkward person, actually. What I did was, okay, if I'm going to put myself on TikTok, it needs to be something I feel comfortable with doing. And I cannot go on TikTok and be like a comedian. I'm not funny in that way. Or be one of those influencers is always like, this is my life, this is my room and everything. I'm like, okay, I'm not like that either. So I spent 2 to 3 weeks on TikTok analyzing the app. Like this whole math account was not by accident. Analyzed the app, wrote down my strengths and my weaknesses. And then I filmed myself just talking about random stuff and analyzed the way I talk. And I was like, okay, what can I do with this? It just was the weirdest experience, kind of like watching and analyzing myself in that way. It's very cringe.
I love it. It's so necessary.
Yeah. So, and I still feel like I have a lot to improve on as well. After that, I also wrote down a lot of my interests. And one of my interests is like STEM, engineering, all that type of stuff. One thing that I found is that there are a couple of math creators on TikTok. I was learning so much from them because my math was never really my strong point despite doing engineering. And I was like, I find this really fascinating. I find this really cool. I feel like this is something that I could learn and then reteach to people on TikTok. So that's how I decided on math. And then that's when we decided on the name Pink Pencil Math, because I didn't want my name on there. I wanted to be an anonymous person. There was no Tanya Zakwich on there, nothing about me. It was just called Pink Pencil Math. And I would wear a pink pencil in my ear. So it's like easy to remember. I read a book on branding about this and I started making videos and it actually took off.
I love that you threw away the line of, I read a book on branding about this. Tell me more about your thoughts, the process of branding yourself, because it's so well done.
Yeah, I did spend a good amount of time on. I went through like different brand names, but one thing that I've always loved is brands that convey imagery and something from the brand name that will make you think of that brand. So for example, like my brand name is Pink Pencil Math. So whenever you see a pink pencil, you might be reminded of, oh, Pink Pencil Math Lady, that math account, or even if you see a pencil. So I like that, being able to remind somebody of that brand. I also love brands that have color in it as well. I mean, it doesn't work for every single brand, but for this, it did. For educational stuff, I feel like colors do work. That was my main criteria and something that sounded cute because that was what I was going for.
I learned the value of money from a very young age. That was another lesson. And so there were many years where we couldn't really afford anything really. And so I said to my dad, I'm going to start working. I'm going to earn some money. And he was like, well, you're 12, so it's not legal. And so when I was 13 and it was legal, I went out and my gosh, I worked about 10 different companies over the next few years, about 3 at any one time. As you said, I guess it was a hustler, but I just loved working and working really hard. I really believe in that phrase, you know, the harder I work, the luckier I get. It's something that I'm teaching my 2-year-old son right now, you know, work really hard. It's the effort you put in that drives a lot of the output.
I feel like that experience scarred you in a way initially to startups, because you end up working for 8 years in Morgan Stanley, which is a very stable job.
You are exactly right. I saw my father have no stable income, just constantly putting every penny that he made from one startup into the next startup. And I thought, how did be good to actually have a salary for a little while, you know, have a sort of typical job. But also I did math and I loved math. And I was like, what's the best way to put math or maths, as we call it in England, to good use? And this was pre-financial crisis. And so back then, working in an investment bank, I only spent 1 year in investment banking, by the way. The rest of it was in research and equity sales, which was just so fun and exhilarating to, you know, be deeply understanding companies and spending time with the CEO and writing reports on like what direction you think the company's going to go. And so I had really loved that job. I didn't think I would stay there for 8 years, but I was between London and New York and worked in both offices. And so did love it.
But the lure of startups was too strong because you ended up angel investing while Morgan Stanley. How did you first start doing that?
Yeah, it's interesting because there was a man who I met through Morgan Stanley and he was angel investing and he sort of taught me about angel investing. I think in America, it's terrific because you learn these things at a young age. You know, you probably learn what it is when you're in school. In England, it's quite the opposite. You don't really know what venture capital is at a young age. You definitely don't know what angel investing is. You sort of heard of private equity as an asset class, but that's about it. And so he taught me about it. And then I started to invest in companies that he introduced me to. And then he had an angel syndicate that he was a part of. And I met the other folks and started to get great deal flow through them as well. And then similar when I was in New York, a lot of the hedge fund folks that we were covering also did angel investing on the side. Good diversification for public market. So I started co-investing with them and really fell in love with early stage investing.
How did you find, or what was the best way you found to network effectively?
Yes, I think it is difficult at university. It's more difficult when you're very early in a new career. So when I first started in VC, I'd be going to these conferences. There'd be hundreds, if not thousands of people at some of these big conferences. And perhaps you wouldn't even know anybody there. So it is quite intimidating just going up to somebody. I'm like, okay, I'm not going to leave this room until I've made 3 good connections. I'm just going to bite the bullet. I'm going to go to the bar, get myself a drink, and then speak to somebody there. And then they'll introduce me to somebody else. By the time you've met 3 people, you were enjoying yourself. And then you want to stay. And before you know it, you've met 50 people. I always think the beginning is the hardest part. So just set yourself a little challenge, be competitive with yourself and say to yourself, I am going to meet 3 people and then meet many, many more.
We spoke about strong personalities. I immediately thought of Lady Gaga because you mentioned that she really knew what she wanted. I wonder, how did you first get involved in building house laboratories? Because you were speaking to her before there was even anything.
Lady Gaga is one of the most incredible people that I have ever met. She deeply believes that you can achieve anything in this world that you set your mind to. And you know, she's definitely a great example of having shown that. You know, she's an Oscar-winning actress, but she set her mind to that. You know, we all know her for her incredible music, because she set her mind to that. And now we're going to have house in many, many stores you're going to see across the country. And so House Labs came, to your point, because Lady Gaga had a very strong view. Her view was like, listen, I've been obsessed with makeups from a very, very young age. I used to play with my mothers. And whenever I'm in the dressing room before going on stage, I'm always like mixing up concoctions with different makeup. And she had this view of like what she wanted her makeup to look like, and then what she wanted a beauty company to look like, which will, you know, then go into hair and skincare. She really, like, to the point of like the ingredients that she wanted in there, and used to be clean, beautiful products, and the names and the models that they were used and the exact shade of coloring. Like, she has strong opinions on everything. And so this is not a company that she is endorsed. This is very much her company. And so we love that. We felt like, gosh, she has deep insights. You know, to the earlier point, it is really what we look for. And I just felt like she was so authentic. So yeah, she's an amazing chairwoman of house.
Then she used to say that I have my fingerprints all over it. It's like a crime scene. And then before you jumped into this investment with her, you also poured over Lady Gaga's Instagram, Twitter, YouTube, just to see whether she had this engaged followership. I wonder, how do you measure engagement?
If it's a social app, then we very closely measure engagement by looking at daily active users over the weekly or monthly active users. But for something like this, you're right. It is much harder to measure engagement. And so we were trying to measure whether Lady Gaga's fans were engaged. And yes, we can see that through her social followings. But are they engaged around beauty? Are they engaged around color cosmetics? I went away on vacation for a week. And on this week, I basically just read through every single comment that I could possibly find about Gaga online. And so it basically took every hour for about a week. And I was reading through and I wanted to see, like, what were people commenting on? Like, were people commenting about her makeup? Were people commenting about her look? Because if that is what people associate with her, then she is going to have much more authenticity in selling that product. And it's true. Like, that is what a lot of people comment on her look and comment on, like, my gosh, you know, one day she'll look like this and then she'll put on this incredible face of makeup and look just the total opposite. And so she was able to, like, command attention and had a real right to win in that space.
Were you ever concerned that you will not be able to separate the celebrity from the company?
It is definitely something that folks talk about. We were early investors in The Honest Company with Jessica Alba. You speak to the CEO, Nick, when they were doing their IPO, he actually said, listen, like, we are a celebrity company, but it is very much product first, celebrity second. So you really want to ensure that the product speaks for itself. And even if that celebrity was not associated with it, people would still be buying the product. And so that's true with Goop or House or The Honest Company. I think that is so important. It's like product first, you know, brand first, and then the celebrity. The celebrity is really just amplifying what's already there. And so, yes, of course, there's key man risk, as there is with anybody exceptional related to a company. You can take out insurance for that, but it doesn't really help to the degree that you need it to. You need to ensure that that celebrity knows this is going to be a 10 plus year journey. I mean, Gwyneth Paltrow has literally been doing Goop for over 10 years. And so as long as they're committed, then that's what's important.
You said before that your parents' attitude was very much, don't ask for permission, ask for forgiveness. How does that translate to life?
Yeah, I guess I grew up with that kind of mentality, just watching how my parents act and the stories that they tell me. When they were younger and they were master's students in Australia, they would go to the World Expo and just, like, do portrait drawings for people. And in a day, they would make like $1,000, which is crazy. And then, like, 1980s, right? That's like a whole person's salary in a month. But they were still very frugal and would still, like, walk every day instead of taking the bus, let alone like a taxi. They decided to do the same thing when they went to, there was a World Expo in Spain. They couldn't get a license in time to actually have a store to do people's art. So they bought a one-way ticket. That was it, $200 with them. And one night was already $100, like with a shitty hostel style, which is crazy expensive. Even now it's crazy expensive. But it was during the World Expo. So they were like, crap, we don't make money. Like, we just have to go home. So they went into the World Expo, bought a attendee ticket, and then just, like, sat down, put out all their art stuff, and then just started, like, drawing portraits. And afterwards, a group of policemen had come, and one of them was, like, telling them, hey, you gotta be here tomorrow. And my dad was like, no, we're not gonna be here tomorrow. And then he was like, oh, I was gonna bring my girlfriend. He was like, oh, yeah, we'll be here tomorrow. After, like, that whole expo, like, couple of months, they went around Europe, went back, bought a car, put a down payment on a house. So that's how much cash they had made during that time. So I was like, wow, you know, you got balls to, like, do that. I guess that's where it came from.
And when you were 16, that was a pretty momentous year because your parents went back to China and only left you $100.
Yeah, that was just after the financial crisis. My parents owned a gallery at the Rocks. Obviously, that is heavily reliant on tourists. And so if no tourists are coming and they're paying expensive rent for prime location in an extremely tourist area, they had to shut that down. There was no money coming in. At the time they left me $100, I think they didn't want to give a huge amount of money to a kid. And then I just, like, recklessly spend it. I think they assumed that I would just ask them for more once I ran out. But I honestly felt really bad. Also, a very non-Asian thing is my parents have always been very transparent with me on their money problems. Ever since I was 9 or 10, they treat me like an adult. I'm responsible for the amounts that they give me. So I was always extremely frugal with even the pocket money that they gave me. So when they gave me $100, I was like, okay, that's it for 3 months. And I think my parents were just, like, so busy at the time. I mean, I'm not that young when I'm 16, you know, they just were like, you can take care of yourself. So I tried to use that $100 as frugally as possible, maybe last like a week and a half. And then I started using my red pocket money. And I was like, you know what? I'll just look for a job. It's not a big deal. people after 13 and a half years old start working at McDonald's and KFC and fast food. I can do that. Just go work after school. So I started applying for all these jobs. And for some reason, I just couldn't get a single one. Not even a fancy job or anything. Everyone would get accepted except me.
Yeah, but that was a good thing for you because...
Yeah, that was great. Well, thank God, because otherwise, if I'd gotten that job, probably entrepreneurship wouldn't exist. I think that you're much more creative when you're facing some sort of blocker. You work around it or you go a different direction. I was like super obsessed at the time. I was really into hip hop. My friends got me into it. And I really wanted these Adidas Jeremy Scott wing shoes. They cost $300 in Australia, kind of like the Yeezys of the day. And all the high school students were super into it. Australia wasn't that much hit by the financial crisis. It was just one quarter of recession. So our currency was doing quite well in comparison to everything else, especially to the US dollar. I used to do ballet and I met this girl a year or two before and her parents had owned an Adidas outlet in the US. And I was asking her, hey, for these type of shoes, especially they're out of season, how much can you sell it to me for? And she was like, oh, these shoes are out of season. So these are $50. And I was like, whoa, from 300? That's crazy. When you convert it into Australian dollars, it was like 40 something dollars. Because Australia's middle of nowhere, shipping is also going to be $40. And I was like, wow, shipping itself is the price of the shoes. But she was like, if you can get a bulk purchase of 20, then we can do a flat fee. And I was like, great. I'm going to ask all my friends if they want to both buy it with me. And so I told my friends, hey, these are $40. Do you want to get it with me? And if we can get 20 people, like we can basically have like shipping for free. When you're 16, you don't really understand the concept of shopping online, or like you don't really understand the concept of wholesale and also currency exchange and out of season. And, you know, Australia's always a season behind, all of those different factors. They were just like, what? How can there be such a big price difference? Like if you go to an outlet now, you'll see Calvin Klein costs $60 for a pair of underwear in Australia. And you will see them in the US for a pack of three for like 12.
You should definitely go to the States to purchase.
Oh, yeah. I was like, wow, we live in an expensive country. Jeez. I was like, wow, that's really interesting. Like the only problem that my friends have is that it's too cheap. So I went to another group of friends. These are all dudes from private schools. And I was like, hey, you know, I have these shoes for $80. Do you want to get them? My justification was that, oh, well, you know, if I don't get 20, like at least it covers my shipping. And actually one of my friends said to me, you know, I can get an order of 20 for you, but what do I get out of this? And I thought it was just a really interesting change of mentality because I went to an all-girls school and everyone was like, if you charge more than what it costs, you're like taking advantage of your friend. But these guys came from very privileged families or like parents of business people. So they had that mentality of like, this is a win-win where if I can make money and you can get it for less, why not? I thought that was really interesting, like the difference in mentality that I saw. And I was like, okay, I dig this. So I told them, I'll charge $80. And if you get an order of 20 by the end of next week, then you can charge whatever you want, as long as it's more than 80. If you want to charge $250, make $170 per pair of shoes, go ahead. And you should just see like these guys, their eyes just like light up. Like minimum viable product was completely free, just one Excel sheet, one Word document with the different colors of the shoes and one Facebook page, which as you know, I called it Crystal Stigili. I don't even know how to say it. I was like, what name should I call this? And my two best friends at the time were called Crystal, Joy, and Lily. So I was like Crystal Jelly and convert it into French. You know, naming things is not a talent of mine.
Yeah, it worked out though. It sounds like it scaled very, very quickly from there. So it sounds like it was word of mouth.
It's crazy like how people overcomplicate how they can make money. But honestly, I was just like trying to do what made sense to me. So I was like, great, this guy wants to, I can clearly see he's incentivized to promote to 20 people. And in order to collect the money first, I said, if your friend decides to order, they have to give me a $40 bond. And when the shoes come and they pay the rest, you can give me the remaining 40 when we swap the shoes, just in case you order a size 43 silver pair of shoes that I can't sell to anybody else. And also, main problem is I don't have the money to pay for it upfront anyway. So that's the main problem. But, you know, you just got to pitch it the other way. And then I went to 9 other friends, said the same thing, all dudes from private schools. Guess that was my market. By the end of that week, these 10 people gave me 20 orders each. So that's 200 pairs of shoes, in which each I made a $40 profit. And that was $8,000 profit. So like 16K revenue roughly in that week. And so what was really interesting was that at least 5 of the 20 people who had bought the shoes would come back to me and say, hey, I know my friend sold me these shoes. Can I also sell it to like my friends? Because I also want to make money. So literally was network marketing to the T. Except unfortunately, I couldn't think of a recurring subscription model or something. Too bad shoes are just one off. But I think network marketing, it works because people trust people that you know. And if you can create an incentivization model that works in the favor of the people helping you promote it, then you can actually grow this really fast. When I look back, the first one is that people keep asking me, like, why did you only take $40? You could have easily taken a much bigger cut. I don't have those networks. So in order to really incentivize my 10 only contacts, I would rather go broad. It would motivate them much more than if I had taken like a 50-50 cut or a majority cut like most people would have done. And I think that like me having the problem of no money really sought out like, I need you to pay me. That's like showing traction, right? Like you need to pay me in order for me to even order these shoes. Like I'm not going to do shit if you don't give me that money first. This is the only model that I knew because I had no money, but it was surprising to me, like a lot of people raise a lot of money or use a lot of their savings to build something that they don't know if it's something that people would pay for. So I feel like I learned those couple of things. And like business to me was really powerful, the way that it can impact the people around you, because all of my friends made a lot of money and then were able to like pay off all the university school fees, or like I bought an investment property when I was 18. So it was like crazy to me, like imagine if I had taken that McDonald's job.
But back to your question about working lots of different jobs, eventually getting gigs on Craigslist. I've always just been a little worker bee. When I first moved to New York to go to college, I was like, I'm going to get a part-time job. I did odd jobs that were not design at all. After freshman year, I realized, hey, I moved across the country to pursue advertising and to work in the creative field. So I quit those jobs and I was like, I'm going to just make money. I'm going to try to just make money from creative things, which is why I headed to Craigslist, because the school had posted internships and Craigslist back in 2010 was the only place I really knew to look. And I don't even know if people are looking to it now, but you know, again, with my grandma's like, do what you can with what you have. Craigslist was what I knew, and I went and looked in the creative gigs section and started sending my portfolio to anybody who had a remotely creative gig. And I did logos for $50, and I drew portraits of people, and I made baby shower presents and anything I could get my hands on. And as soon as I started doing that, I got a rush. I really do think that was the foundation for building my confidence. I can do anything that I want. I just have to do it in baby steps and figure out little ways to build trust and let people know that I'm offering these services.
Didn't you start this project when you were 22, which is called Daily Dishonesty? How did that come about? You've said before that you owe your entire career to Daily Dishonesty.
I do. I technically do, because you hear people hypothetically talk about, as a musician or artist or creative, you need your big break. And that was my big break. It came sooner than I was prepared for it. To backtrack a little bit, as I'm looking for gigs on Craigslist in college, I started a Tumblr blog where I was hand lettering little white lies that my girlfriends and I would tell ourselves. We were 21 at the time, and it would be little things that my roommates and I would say, like, you know, I'll do the dishes tomorrow. Or you'd be like, hey, you know, we're going out, like, are you ready? And you'd be like, I'm almost ready, but you actually haven't even started getting ready, or I'll be there in 5 minutes. I think it's a combination of all the things we've been talking about, where I was taking bits of my daily life, like the assignments that teachers gave. But Gail Anderson gave us assignments like, design an ABC book about any topic of your choice, or design a deck of cards about any deck of cards. So most people did playing cards, right? But I did recipe cards because I love to cook. But Gail's open-ended assignments really set me up for doing my own thing. So Daily Dishonesty, I was like, I'm going to do a couple of these a week and I'm going to post them to this blog and they're all going to be lies. It's going to be a big collection of little white lies. And so I started publishing these and within a couple weeks, they started like slowly circulating around Tumblr and then they picked up a little more steam. And by the time I was graduating college, a literary agent had stumbled across the project and reached out and put together a book proposal and we sold it to a publisher. So I had a book deal when I graduated college for a lettering project that I started.
It was a $25,000 book deal.
Yeah, at the time I was probably charging $20 an hour for freelance work with book stuff. You get half up front and then half afterwards. So they make sure you actually do the book. But that was the most money I had ever gotten in my life. So someone who's 22, I mean, $25,000 may as well have been $500,000 to me.
But the incredible thing is that when you create that book, they don't let you reproduce everything they've already done. You have to do what? 70% of it has to be new. So the obvious question I'm sure everyone listening is, how did you find the time?
Well, those 9 months that I worked at the advertising agency, pretty much all of my spare time was spent working on these Daily Dishonesty illustrations for the book. Because you are correct. When you go from a personal project online to a published book, they want to make sure that readers have enough of an incentive to buy the book. So it needed to be 70% new. Is the ability to manage your own time and take advantage of different pockets of time. You work in a regular schedule. Some weeks might be 60 hours, some weeks might be 20 hours. So it's a trade-off. And so I've gotten good at managing my own time. And when I need to produce a large amount of work, I can just sit down and do it. And so I'm grateful for those early training days, I suppose. So I try not to do it too much now.
How did it go viral, I suppose? Were you actively reaching out to people? Because eventually you appeared in the Los Angeles magazine and that brought it to a whole other level.
Yeah, it started organically because I was lettering these things that people could relate to. I'll be there in 5 minutes. It was a naturally shareable project. People started sharing it among their peers. And then other artists started reaching out to me asking, hey, this is a really cool project. Can I contribute one? So I started letting people contribute their own little white lie. And it became 90% me, 10% guest artists. But it expanded to being collaborative. And then some more designers started knowing about it. And then my literary agent reached out to me a couple months after launching the blog because she had saw a couple pieces on Pinterest. And she said, hey, in order to make this more attractive to publishers, you should send your blog out to these 100 websites to see if they'll do a profile on it or feature it. I reached out. I was so surprised at how many people said yes. And if you pitch something that's genuinely a good fit for their publication, you're helping them do their job better. You just made their life easier. And so for anyone who's listening who's afraid to pitch or to put their work out there, just send the email. The worst that can happen is you don't get a response.